This is the Annie Fry Show.
Yeah, I mean, we have been waiting to see this next sort of important hurdle for Kamala Harris and her campaign to jump, which is after a very successful 6 weeks here. All of that, though, Alex, very scripted. Now, a couple other things coming up. They said they were going to schedule an interview, a sit-down interview, an extensive interview before the end of the month. That now is happening on CNN with our colleague Dana Bash, our anchor and chief political correspondent, down in Georgia. Harris and Walz are going on this bus tour starting tomorrow in Georgia. The interview will take place on Thursday. It will air as a primetime special at 9 p.m. Eastern here on CNN on Thursday.
So we're going to get to see Kamala Harris sit down for an interview. She's going to introduce herself once again to the American people by answering your questions filtered through the media interviewer of Dana Bash. Oh, and Tim Walz is going to be there. Is that weird? I think it's weird. I think a lot of people are making a lot of presumptions about this interview, but let's sit down and wait and see what happens. The number one thing that I will want to know after this interview is over is, did they edit any of it? Because do you remember all the lead up to the Joe Biden conversation with George Stephanopoulos? It was George, right? Wasn't that who it was? I was trying to think of this earlier.
Yeah.
I was thinking it was Jake Tapper. I'm like, no, that's not right. It was Stephanopoulos. Mm-hmm. Everybody was getting ready for that. And you thought, oh, Stephanopoulos, he's part of the Democrat system. He comes right out of the Clinton apparatus. Well, that interview didn't help him. Do you remember how much ado was made about post-Joe Biden debate, all the way up till that, I believe it was a Thursday, when he officially said he was not going to run for re-election any longer? We watched him double, triple, quadruple down over and over and over again. I'm the candidate. He said, and I quote, only God could get me out of this. I don't know if that's a quote, direct quote, but he basically said that it would require either a medical diagnosis or God himself to get him out of this race. To which Theo Vaughn, when he was talking to Donald Trump, said they dressed somebody up like God and chased him out of there. That's Theo Vaughn. Go watch that interview if you haven't. If you haven't had the time yet, find it on YouTube. Find it on Theo Vaughn's, wherever. I think he put it on X as well. So you can watch it wherever most people put that stuff. But I watched it on YouTube, and it's a very interesting interview. But we were emphatically told that Joe Biden was the candidate over and over and over again. And you, maybe like me, was like, no. But you're running out of time, folks. You're going to need to get in there and get the job done if you're going to get to plan B. Maybe Joe Biden was always the plan B. I don't know. But it was Joe Biden, Joe Biden, Joe Biden, Joe Biden. Nope, not Joe Biden. Kamala Harris. Well, what? Wait, what? Don't we get a say in? No, you get no say in this. I certainly don't, because I'm not a Democratic voter. That was 38 days ago that took place, that he stepped down and that Kamala became the candidate, the person who he endorsed on a tweet. He sent out a tweet. Excuse me. Somebody sent out a tweet and said, I'm out. So you're telling me, remember that press conference that Joe Biden did? I mean, folks, this just happened. This is not like super old news. I mean, it's old news in the way that days go in a political cycle. But Joe Biden was defiant and obviously visibly aggravated, angry that he was put into this position and oppositional to the idea that maybe you're not the guy, Joe. And then one day he just wasn't any longer. And we're all like, okay, when's Kamala going to do an interview? All right. Month goes by. Hasn't done an interview yet. Does the woman who wants to be the president of the United States need more than a month to come up with time to sit down and speak to the American people for the question and answer session? She should know all the answers. She is the answers. She herself she's campaigning to be the answer, so that whatever question comes up for the next 4 years, no matter what that question is, that she's going to be there to answer that question, that we're supposed to entrust her with the knowledge, the expertise, the experience, and the wisdom to be able to answer that question when she is faced with it. Is she going to tell Putin, I need some time? Oh, and I need a man to sit next to me to help me out. Oh, it's weird. Listen. I am not a postmodern feminist. I got a little touch of the OG feminist, I think. Growing up, I've told the story. This is just a funny story that when I think about it, I have to tell it again. I remember vividly, I was about 8 years old, and I remember going into the garage at my house, obviously where my parents lived, I was eight, and I was helping my dad with his garden. And I don't know about you all in your gardens, but every year my dad would pour his heart and soul into this beautiful vegetable garden that would inevitably be eaten by rabbits and deer. And so every year we would get spoils from this garden, but then one crop or another would get eaten up and he'd spend all this time into making this garden happen. And then it would make him so mad. And so I remember going out and we'd harvest potatoes and I'd pick green beans and, you know, whatever it was that was out in the garden that he needed help with. And I was milling around with him and we were going into the garage and we had picked, I'm pretty sure at that point it was potatoes because I remember being specifically dirty. And I said, Dad, why, you know, if we grew all this, what if we just grew more and we just fed other people and other people could do things to help us and we wouldn't need to have money anymore and we could just help people? And my dad looked at me in the garage and goes, Annie, you're a communist. And then he just left the garage. That was the end of it. And it was like, here's this very innocent, genuine idea that this eight-year-old had. And the truth of the matter was, it doesn't work that way, honey. And I mean, that's what he was saying in his very loving, fatherly way. It stuck, Dad. You did a good job, I think. I mean, it probably depends on who you ask. But, you know, this idea that you can present to the American people this thought that there is an equal outcome that you can guarantee people. Kamala Harris, in her grown woman years, has really pushed for equal outcomes. She has in her mind the idea that the government can come in and suppress prices to control the outcome. Her solution to every problem that exists is Kamala Harris being in the position to make the decisions for the equal outcome. It's patently un-American. I haven't asked him, but maybe my dad would say she's a communist. I don't know. I'll have to ask him sometime. We know that what Kamala Harris has to offer is un-American at its core. I believe that there are a lot of people who look at Kamala Harris and see what she's trying to do, and the outcome, much like my eight-year-old self, feels like, well, that would be the nicest thing to do. That would be pleasant if everybody had what they needed. And we could just work to provide for each other. But that's not how it works. It hasn't been functional yet in society, and I don't see it happening functionally in this country either. When Kamala Harris is supposed to go sit down for this interview, as a woman, and I would assume she's much more of the postmodern feminist walk than just the traditional feminist walk. Why in the world does she want Tim Walz sitting in there? Maybe she doesn't want Tim Walz, and maybe the campaign that is puppeting her through this entire thing is like, he's going to be sitting there. I mean, is he supposed to be there for the yuck of the whole thing? Is he supposed to lighten the mood? I mean, this is the joy and vibes campaign. Do they do better at, can they laugh at each other's jokes? I can't remember what the whole line is, but Denzel Washington says in Remember the Titans when they're getting on the bus for the first time to go to camp. Who are the two characters? Dean Martin and who's the other one? He talks to these two of the white boys who are getting on, who are like, here's how things are going to go. Because the whole movie of Remember the Titans is about combining this black school and this white school and the story, which is an amazing movie. I don't know who out there has not seen it, but you should. Especially now, because it's football season. These two arrogant white football players go to this black coach and say, here's how it's going to go. And Denzel Washington says, essentially, makes fun of him and says, you're Dean Martin. And then I can't remember who the other one is. Somebody will tell me on the chat here. And I just feel like that's kind of what the Kamala Tim 1-2 punch is going to be in this interview. They're going to try to come off Jerry Lewis. Thank you, Christine. You're my hero. Dean and Jerry. That's exactly right. This is what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to come out and they're supposed to entertain you. They're supposed to make you want more of how happy and joyful this partnership is. And they can do that better if they're with each other, because listen, every joke is funnier when you hear other people laughing about it. If I tell a joke here and you think it's funny, or if Ryan tells a joke and I laugh and think it's funny, it probably becomes funnier for you to hear it because I'm laughing with you. And I think that this entire Harris-Walls campaign is 100% solely about feelings. And the best way that they can convey the enemy here, and I say enemy specifically, not opponent, but enemy, Donald Trump is their mortal enemy. The best way to draw the contrast they feel is valuable to them come election season is to contrast the anger and the temperament that exists on the Trump side of the ticket by mirroring it in a way that is the exact opposite, where they are joyful and they are smiling and they can look at each other. We'll wait and see. Maybe they'll come out and they'll just be like daggers in the eyes. I doubt it. I'm really looking forward to the time where Kamala Harris says, we need to build that wall. And Tim Walz looks at him and goes, what the hell? Like, where did that come from? What are you talking about? That's not what we signed up for. Mr. Tim Walz, who says, you tell me how high that is. If you tell me that the wall is 28 feet high, I'm going to invest in a 30-foot ladder company. Are we going to ask Tim Walz about that? It's very bizarre to me that the campaign that picked Kamala Harris because she was a woman of color, that's Joe Biden's words, Kamala Harris became more qualified than any of the other opportunities of folks out there, men or women alike, to be his VP on the ticket because she was a woman of color. I mean, I would think that that would mean that is, at least to the left, that being female is an asset over being male. Why is it that Kamala Harris is going to need Tim Walz sitting next to her? I think it's for the vibes factor. I think that we will see, and I could be completely wrong, Dana Bash interview them, and the two of them make the lightheartedness of the campaign continue from the vibes convention to the vibes interview. They don't have to answer any questions specifically. They can talk to each other. I mean, anytime that an interviewer is sitting down there asking questions, watch how many times they interrupt somebody like J.D. Vance. Watch how many times they interrupt to correct someone like Donald Trump. Even when it's absolutely Leslie Stahl. Wasn't it Leslie Stahl who was talking to Donald Trump about, I can't remember what the specific issue was. Donald Trump was correcting her as it went, and she ended up being proved completely false in an inconsequential time.
On 60 Minutes.
Yes. I don't remember what the issue was specifically. I think it was the laptop.
Yeah, it was Hunter's laptop.
Hunter's laptop. He's like, it's verifiable. And she's like, it is not verifiable. Yeah. She couldn't be bothered. It's like, turn your head and close your eyes and move your hair from your shoulder. I got to suffer through this interview with Donald Trump. They interrupt, they correct, they take up the time of the person who they're interviewing, and watch how they do this. Watch how Dana Bash asks these questions of Kamala Harris. I was very happily surprised and impressed by the way Jake Tapper and Dana Bash handled the CNN debate with Joe Biden and Donald Trump. So I'm going to keep my eyes open, my ears open to see how this goes. It's a really big get for Dana Bash. And of all the places that they went to, people were like, oh, well, this is going to be a softball interview. The only place they would have a super challenging interview is at Fox, and they're not going to do that. They won't even do a Fox debate. So we'll wait and see. But if you see in this interview this sort of Jerry Lewis, Dean Martin back and forth between the two, trying to keep the vibes going in their favor, trying to keep it lighthearted, then you'll know they certainly don't take you seriously. We'll wait and see. When we come back, Mike Davis is going to join us, and I am excited to talk to Mike. I haven't talked to him for a while. He's the founder and president of the Article 3 Project, and he's going to talk to us about the new Jack Smith, the revisions of his indictment on election interference with Donald Trump. What is going on with Jack Smith, and what will the eventual outcome be of this continued lawfare? Our friend Mike Davis on The Andy Frey Show next.
The new indictment over Donald Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 presidential election suddenly brings his conduct around the Capitol attack back to the fore of this year's intensifying race for the White House. The slimmed-down indictment from 45 pages to 36 pages still alleges Trump engaged in a conspiracy to hold on to power, and it comes in the wake of the Supreme Court ruling that presidents have broad immunity for official acts. It removed all the allegations concerning Trump's attempts to pressure the Justice Department into supporting his false claims that the election was rigged.
There's the CBS News report about the new Jack Smith indictments that came out yesterday. And we want to get our friend Mike Davis back on the show to tell us exactly what's going on with the latest installment in lawfare against the former president and current nominee for the Republican side of the aisle for president of the United States. He's the founder and president of the Article 3 Project. Mike Davis is here with us again. Mike, welcome back. It's good to have you here.
Thank you for having me back on.
Yeah, of course. Give us the lay of the land of what this re-indictment means against Donald Trump from Jack Smith.
This is a desperate move by Biden and Kamala and Merrick Garland and Jack Smith to try to take out President Trump through this lawfare, this last ditch effort to take out Trump with lawfare and election interference, because they fear Trump's going to beat Kamala like a drum on November 5th, 2024. And the polling is not good for Kamala. She did not get her post-convention bounce that she was supposed to get. Trump stole that bounce when he got RFK Jr.'s endorsement and then Tulsi Gabbard's endorsement. So Trump is the uniter, bringing in high-profile Democrats into his movement, and Kamala is the divider, and they're desperate. And that's, you're seeing the desperation with Jack Smith's superseding indictment. He is ignoring, and Merrick Garland, who had to personally sign off on this, they are ignoring the Supreme Court's recent monumental decisions in the Fisher case, where the Supreme Court clearly held that the Biden-Kamala Justice Department illegally contorted, politicized, weaponized a post-Enron obstruction of justice statute to go after corporate fraud that they deployed against their political enemies after January 6th, that two of those four counts in Jack Smith's original indictment against Trump included 18 U.S.C. 1512, this corporate fraud statute. After the Supreme Court's Fisher ruling, Jack Smith superseded his indictment, and they're still in there. They still have these two counts under 18 U.S.C. 1512 that the Supreme Court says that you can't use, right? So it's obvious that Jack Smith and Merrick Garland and Biden and Kamala are ignoring the Supreme Court's Fisher decision. They're also ignoring the Supreme Court's presidential immunity decision, where the Supreme Court made very, very clear you cannot charge a president of the United States, any president, for his official acts as the president, including the outer perimeter of his official acts, which is an extension of a civil case, the Nixon case from 40 years ago. And they did that in this indictment. This indictment specifically includes President Trump's discussions with his vice president that the Supreme Court said was presumptively immune. So look, there's no chance this case will get tried before the election. But I think what Jack Smith is trying to do is get a mini trial, an evidentiary hearing in front of D.C. Obama judge Tanya Shuckin, this partisan operative in a robe, to keep Trump trapped in a courtroom between now and the election instead of the campaign trail. It's going to backfire, like I've been predicting for 2 years of this lawfare. It's going to help Trump. It's going to actually make it where Trump beats Kamala even more handily than we thought.
We're speaking with Mike Davis, the founder and president of the Article 3 Project. You can go to article3project.org to learn more about his efforts. Mike Davis, so when I am thinking back to, let's say, 2016, October, end of October of 2016, and listening to James Comey and the way he talked about, you know, the emails that existed and the different things that maybe could have been looked into more, but they didn't because it'd be election interference and they didn't want the justice system to get in the midst of pushing the election one way or the other. And now we have the Justice Department prosecuting a nominee for election interference in a time where I feel like it would be election interference themselves for the actions that they're taking. I mean, it's like kind of like an inception thing going on here.
So Merrick Garland and Jack Smith, with Biden and Kamala's blessing, waited 30 months to bring these original charges against Trump. And then the Supreme Court just ruled in June on Fisher and presidential immunity. We are, we're within almost 70 days of the November 5th election. Early voting starts in just a couple weeks. Jack Smith could have waited until after the election to bring this superseding indictment. It's very clear that he brought this superseding indictment for the purpose of interfering in the 2024 election. They know that Kamala is not performing where she needs to be right now after her convention. And so, voila, Jack Smith, this political Scud missile, comes out of nowhere to launch this Scud missile against Trump. This is the same Jack Smith who was deployed during the Obama administration to go after then former governor Bob McDonnell from Virginia, a likely presidential or vice presidential contender in 2016. Jack Smith used a bogus legal theory of corruption to take out Bob McDonnell. He got a criminal conviction. That conviction was overturned 8-0 by the Supreme Court of the United States. It would have been 9-0, but Justice Scalia passed away. But Jack Smith did what he was set out to do, which is to destroy Bob McDonnell politically for 2016. And it didn't matter that he got reversed several years later by the Supreme Court. That was the same play that they're trying to, that is the same play that they're trying to do here. Their goal is to destroy Trump before the November 5th election this year. And they know that the Supreme Court is not going to uphold any conviction on this case. They know it. It is a bogus case on so many different levels. But the fact that they're blatantly ignoring the Supreme Court's Fisher decision and presidential immunity decision from just several months ago is pretty telling.
Mike Davis speaking with us right now with the Article 3 Project. If I think about the legal challenges that Donald Trump has had to face in the last year or so, it's been a pretty dramatic amount of time, this timeline where he has had all of these legal challenges thrown at him. Every time that they have been elevated to the Supreme Court, it seems as though, save one in Manhattan, Donald Trump has really stuck the landing and ended up almost for the better with the lawfare, the legal concerns that are being used only for the purpose of politics. But they did get their convicted felon moniker for Donald Trump. I want to know what your assessment is of the efforts being made by this Justice Department to use lawfare to win an election. Do you think that the convicted felon is enough victory for them to have made the impact they want? Or do you think that Donald Trump is really benefiting from the legal challenges that have been thrown his way?
Trump, look, at the Article 3 Project, we have turned lemons into lemonade. We've done over 4,000 media hits since the Mar-a-Lago raid, since this started. And we have changed the politics of this, where the Democrats thought that this lawfare would destroy Trump. They thought a criminal conviction would destroy Trump. And we've changed the politics, which makes it easier for these judges, including on the Supreme Court, to follow the law. And the American people understand, after our efforts at the Article 3 Project over the last 2 years, that this is lawfare. This is election interference. These are bogus cases. And the people who pretend like they want democracy, they're protecting democracy, are sure doing a funny job of protecting democracy. They disenfranchised 15 million Democrat primary voters for Biden and installed Kamala Harris in a bloodless coup, who's never won a Democrat primary vote in her life. And then they tried to bankrupt Trump with a bogus fraud case in New York. They've tried to throw him in prison for the rest of his life with these bogus criminal cases, four bogus criminal cases. They're still trying to do it. Jack Smith is the Freddy Krueger of politics. He's been legally killed five times and he keeps coming back, right? You know, his ears are cut off and he's bleeding, but he's back. And so then they're trying to throw him in prison. They try to take him off the ballot in Colorado and Maine. The Supreme Court stepped in and stopped them. So what did Biden and Kamala, Democrats, do? They're trying to destroy the Supreme Court that got in their way. And then Biden and Kamala intentionally underfunded Trump's Secret Service protection, denied several requests from Trump's career Secret Service detail. And then Biden said to put a bullseye on Trump after they said Trump is an existential threat to democracy, a Hitler who has to be stopped at all costs. What the hell did they think was going to happen? And we saw what happened in Butler, Pennsylvania. Look, they can't stop Trump. This is he's unstoppable. The American people understand that they get to pick the next president, not these Biden and Kamala Democrat prosecutors and judges and witness and other operatives and these Democrat hellholes of New York, D.C., and Atlanta. This all backfired, and now this is their last desperate attempt with this corrupt judge Juan Merchan in New York. They want to throw Trump in prison. I just, you know, politically, selfishly, I say do it. Put him in prison for an hour. The Supreme Court of the United States will step in immediately and stop them. They'll turn Trump into a legend, Nelson Mandela, and then he's going to be absolutely unstoppable. He'll win in a complete landslide.
Mike Davis speaking with us right now. Before we let you go, you've really laid out what the apparatus right now, the bureaucracy and the Justice Department is doing to try to preserve themselves, truthfully. When Donald Trump gets elected, should he be elected, and you have a lot of confidence that he will be, what does the Trump administration need to do to rectify this situation so that no Republican, Democrat, independent, no American ever needs to feel like they're on the wrong side of politics, therefore they will be on an opposite side of justice?
Retribution is a key part of justice, and it's a key deterrent, and it's also good for the victims to have retribution. And I think there needs to be retribution, and it needs to be for the real crimes by Biden and Kamala Democrats, where they have politicized, going back to Obama, politicized and weaponized our intel agencies and our law enforcement at the federal level and all these different states like New York AG's office, the Manhattan DA's office, the Fulton County DA's office, the DC US Attorney's office. They have politicized and weaponized our legal system and our intel agencies to go after Trump, his top aides like Steve Bannon, who's in prison, Peter Navarro, who went to prison, his lawyers like John Eastman, Jeff Clark, Rudy Giuliani, his supporters on January 6th, who the Supreme Court essentially said were politically persecuted in the Fisher decision. There needs to be serious legal, political, and financial consequences so this never happens again. So I would say to these Biden and Kamala prosecutors and judges and lawyers and other operatives, lawyer up, because justice is coming. And as you guys like to say, nobody's above the law.
Mike Davis, we love having you on the show, and we look forward to having you back again soon. 69 days until the election. It's going to be incredibly consequential. And with a fair election, I think you're right. Donald Trump's going to win. We'll wait and see.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mike Davis with the Article 3 Project. He is their founder and president. Check them out online at article3project.org. That's the number 3, article3project.org. We're going to take a quick break. Wiggins America in studio. When we come back, looking forward to having a chat with Ryan when he comes in here. In the 1 o'clock hour, we're going to speak with DeRoy Murdoch as well. And he's going to react to the RFK Jr. endorsement of Donald Trump. And I think he's got something to say about the way his family embraced. No, they didn't embrace him. They didn't embrace him at all. They kind of gave him the boot again. DeRoy Murdoch at 1 o'clock, but Ryan Wiggins next. Don't go away. Every time we play this song, I talk about Pee Wee Herman. This is the only thing I think of. Am I interrupting something over there, Ryan?
No, I was just taking a little drink and my ice. How often does ice come out of the straw? There's a tiny little piece shot up right in my mouth. Scared me a little bit.
I started to talk to Ryan. He was over there having a snack.
Ah! I was panicking that you were going to start talking to me.
Well, just don't take a drink right when we go on the air.
Well, I wanted to wet my mouth a little bit, and that's how you do it. But when a piece of ice shoots up, you just get surprised.
45 minutes to do that before you got in here.
Well, yeah. My mouth sometimes gets dry at other times in the day, not just at like 12:20. So I have to repeatedly drink.
How about 1244?
1244 is one of those times.
That would have been one of those times.
Yeah.
The tequila song is a divider. It's like a marker, a definitive marker of millennials. And I may also add in centennials, because when you hear tequila, if you don't think about Pee Wee Herman, then you are a certain age.
Yeah.
Younger than, let's see, what movie came out in the late 80s?
I think it was mid-80s.
Mid-80s?
Mm. I'm going to say 85.
Pee-wee Herman's Big Adventure?
Yeah. The show was later.
The show was after the movie?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
1985.
No. 1985, I was right about the movie?
I thought he got the movie because of the show.
Yeah.
Pee-wee's Playhouse.
And then Pee-wee's Playhouse was like a spinoff of like a stage show or something. He was a character that guy did. Paul Reubens?
There's three things I know about him. One of them is that he had a movie. One of them is that he had a show. And the other is that he went to the movies.
That, you're not far off. That's what most Americans know. Yeah.
Wiggins. Oh, Wiggins.
I got more Pee-wee material.
We know.
The movie came out in 1985. The show came out in 1986. So
movie first.
The movie came out first. Were you a big fan of the show?
I liked it. It was fun.
You were probably pretty young.
We grew up with five channels.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure or Pee-wee's Playhouse was competing against like Ricky Lake. Probably later, but like Phil Donahue. I'm choosing Pee-wee.
Sally, Jesse, Raphael.
Mm-hmm.
1986 to 1990. And it was on reruns until 1991, when it suddenly stopped being in reruns because of the news items.
I think about regularly as a parent. For instance, I told a story about watching The Goonies, and the beginning of The Goonies is the movie's PG, but the beginning of The Goonies doesn't strike me as PG. There's the whole statue. The statue falls over.
Oh, yeah.
A part breaks off of the statue. They glue the part back on wrong. It's upside down. It's my mom's favorite part. And I'm like, hey, kids, let's watch movies from my childhood. Let's turn on The Goonies. And then we're watching this, and I don't remember any of that. It's happening, and I'm like, whoa.
Yeah, we watched it.
And then I'm sitting there, and it's like I'm thinking, I'm panicking. I'm in a full panic because I'm thinking, do I laugh nervously because it's actually pretty hilarious? Or do I like create a diversion over here, like fall out of my chair lay on the floor like, oh, I'm hurt. Oh, I feel okay. I'm good.
I hit myself in the face with a pillow over and over.
Or do I sit very quietly and maybe they're not paying full attention, which is what I ended up doing. And as that's happening, their jaws drop and they slow pan with the biggest saucer eyes to mom. And I'm like, I don't remember this part.
Wait, did you say that was your favorite part or your mom's favorite part of the movie?
The statue is in the house, and I'm not going to be descriptive because I know some of you are riding with impressionable ears in your car, your husband.
The statue of David.
The statue is in the, and then they knock the statue over, and there's a part of the statue of David that falls off, it breaks off, and they glue it back on, but they glue it on wrong because they didn't know.
They glue it on
upside down.
Yeah, facing the wrong direction.
And Frodo, or whatever the Hobbit's name is. What's his name? Sean Astin.
Yeah. He would have been better as Frodo at that age.
He goes, oh, no. Or he either says it or someone else says, oh, no, that's his mom's favorite part.
Oh, okay. Because I thought you said just like fleetingly, that's my mom's favorite part.
No.
And I was like, wait a minute.
It sounds like something Mouth would say.
No, but they say that. And it was like in unison, my kids just slow pan and look at me like, we thought we knew you. And I was like, I don't remember this part of the movie. But my 14-year-old's like, I'm like, sorry, now you know. You're learning things from The Goonies. I guess there's a... But anyway, this is all to say that when we were growing up, like, I was like, embarrassed that my kids saw that, and I'd let them see it. Our parents would go to work, and we would watch Jenny Jones and Jerry Springer.
Oh, my gosh.
And like... Everybody did that. It wasn't like we had selective.
Yeah,
that's what television was.
On. It was just on. You had a TV in your room
a lot of times. You'd watch soap operas because it was what was on.
I mean, I tried to avoid soap operas, but it was on TV. So I did probably watch them at some point.
Man, the 80s and the 90s were a little bit different. I do say, though, that the way that hit in the 80s or the 90s is incredibly different because we were not all day saturated in sex the way kids are today. The exposure to that type of stuff today is way more. I mean, even in commercials on the television while you're like watching a baseball game or something like that, there are things where it's like, especially going into the Halloween season, where like you're going to be watching and all of a sudden you've got like a possessed woman eating somebody's face off or something like that. It's like, whoa, my three-year-old didn't need to see that, but here we are. It's been seen.
And it's not just that it's oversaturated. It's that we knew back then this is not really, we're watching, we're peeking behind the curtain.
Yeah.
This isn't normal.
Yeah.
And that's
now it's
important.
Everywhere.
Yeah,
and
it's important.
Much more realistic than it ever was when we were growing up.
So what I brought for you for Wiggins America today is a series of stories about California. I've done this before, of course, but there's a thesis here that I want you to think about when I'm giving you these stories. You've heard the phrase before, what happens in America first happens in California, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's heard that. So when I read these stories, I want to know whether you think that this really is a harbinger of things to come for the country. Of course, it's probably no surprise that these are not positive things. The first one is that California will be the first U.S. state to direct, this is breaking news in the last day or so, first U.S. state to direct millions of dollars from taxpayer money and tech companies to help pay for journalism and AI research under a new deal announced on Wednesday. Governor Gavin Newsom said, quote, "This agreement represents a major breakthrough in ensuring the survival of newsrooms and bolstering local journalism across California. Leveraging substantial tech industry resources without imposing new taxes on Californians, the deal not only provides funding to support hundreds of new journalists, but helps rebuild a robust and dynamic California press corps for years to come, reinforcing the vital role of journalism in our democracy."
What are the requirements to receive the funding?
There's a lot of detail to this. All it says in real detail is that they modeled it after Canadian support of their journalists in Canada. So we're talking about some of their news networks. This is mostly local to California, like local news,
mm-hmm.
now going to be government funded in California. That is frightening, first of all. But second, my question for you is this a harbinger of things to come? We're very close to being state-run media as it is. Could this ever be federalized?
I don't know. How could it be?
I'm looking
at a free press. The First Amendment, a free press can't be federalized.
Well, it's not going to be a free press in California anymore. It's going to be subsidized by the government. I mean, this is the first time we've ever seen this.
Well, but that's kind of the thing. That's the rub. If there's requirements that to receive this funding, you have to make sure that you do A, B, and C, then yes, there's undue influence there. If this is just, hey, here's the government funding to ensure that everything works and keeps going, that's not necessarily the government's heavy hand, but it is a doorway to open that up, to let people in.
And can't you still report? I mean, everybody can still report. You just don't get the funding.
Well, I'm just saying this is the first time we've ever seen taxpayer money allocated to support journalism.
No, wait, that's NPR.
NPR does
PBS?
It a little bit. There's like 9%.
All that they do.
No, it's like 8 or 9% of their funding comes from the government. So that is there.
But it's the same thing.
But yeah, I mean, this is the first time that we've seen, and that the intent of that is so old that it was like, well, we need something for basically kids programming and stuff that's not partisan, and then it became partisan. I think that's almost like that's almost showing exactly what's going to happen here. That it's going to start by saying, no, we're not going to dictate what they can say, but that's got to be where this goes, right? They will eventually want to say in what's reported.
Want to say and be able to say are two different things. And I think that if you have a constitutional case, and I think you have a very strong constitutional argument where they can offer you this money, you can take the money, and you are under no like requirements to do what they tell you to do. I think if you took that up to the Supreme Court, I think you're going to win that every day of the week.
Ooh. I don't know if my sweeper is up, but I'm going to play it anyway. There we go. Hey. Nice, Brad. Next one is California is opening, quote unquote, free food markets that are costing, of course, taxpayer money. San Francisco has opened a city market on Sunday where qualifying residents can receive their groceries for, quote unquote, free. This is a supplemental source for food on top of food stamps, and they show pictures of this. It's basically homeless encampments that are being subsidized because, like we've said before, they're not signing up for the programs. They're creating literal bread lines in the United States. Again, I ask, I hope, do you think this is something we could ever see in the United States, that we go back to seeing bread lines across the country?
I mean, you just said what we are.
I'm just saying it's in California right now. I'm not seeing it
here
yet.
They are in the United States.
They are in the United States.
I know, it's shocking.
Barely.
Yeah.
I mean, we're seeing it. Last one, real quick, is California's has banned single-use plastic grocery bags a long time ago, but they're seeing that it doesn't work and that there's a lot more plastic usage because people are not reusing their bags as they were supposed to.
Well, when we come back, we're going to speak with DeRoy Murdoch. We're going to talk about that RFK Jr. endorsement and how his family reacted to all of that. Don't go away. Play this song. I talk about Pee Wee Herman. This is the only thing I think of. Am I interrupting something over there, Ryan?
No, I was just taking a little drink and my ice. How often does ice come out of the straw? There's a tiny little piece shot up right in my mouth. Scared me a little bit.
I started to talk to Ryan. He was over there having a snack.
Ah! I was panicking that you were going to start talking to me.
Well, just don't take a drink right when we go on the air.
Well, I wanted to wet my mouth a little bit, and that's how you do it. But when a piece of ice shoots up, you just get surprised.
45 minutes to do that before you got in here.
Yeah. My mouth sometimes gets dry at other times in the day, not just at like 12:20. So I have to repeatedly drink.
How about 12:44?
12:44 is one of those times.
That would have been one of those times.
Yeah.
The tequila song is a divider. It's like a marker, a definitive marker of millennials. And I may also add in centennials, because when you hear tequila, if you don't think about Pee Wee Herman, then you are a certain age.
Yeah.
Younger than... Let's see, what movie came out in the late 80s?
I think it was mid-80s.
Mid-80s?
Mm. I'm going to say 85.
Pee Wee Herman's Big Adventure?
Yeah. The show was later.
The show was after the movie?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure.
1985.
No. 1985, I was right about the movie?
I thought he got the movie because of the show.
Yeah.
Pee Wee's Playhouse.
And then Pee Wee's Playhouse was like a spinoff of like a stage show or something. He was a character that guy did. Paul Rubin?
There's three things I know about him. One of them is that he had a movie. One of them is that he had a show. And the other is that he went to the movies.
That you're not far off. That's what most Americans know. Yeah.
Wiggins. Wiggins.
I got more Pee Wee material.
We know.
The movie came out in 1985. The show came out in 1986. So... The movie came out first. Were you a big fan of the show?
I liked it. It was fun.
You were probably pretty young.
We grew up with five channels.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Pee-wee's Big Adventure or Pee-wee's Playhouse was competing against like Ricky Lake.
Yeah.
Probably later, but like Phil Donahue. I'm choosing Pee-wee.
Sally, Jesse, Raphael.
Mm-hmm.
1986 to 1990. And it was on reruns until 1991, when it suddenly stopped being in reruns because of the news items.
I think about regularly as a parent. For instance, I told a story about watching The Goonies, and the beginning of The Goonies is the movie's PG, but the beginning of The Goonies doesn't strike me as PG. There's the whole statue. The statue falls over.
Oh, yeah.
A part breaks off of the statue. They glue the part back on wrong. It's upside down. It's my mom's favorite part. And I'm like, hey, kids, let's watch movies from my childhood. Let's turn on The Goonies. And then we're watching this, and I don't remember any of that. It's happening, and I'm like, whoa.
Yeah, we watched it.
And then I'm sitting there, and it's like I'm thinking, I'm panicking. I'm in a full panic because I'm thinking, do I laugh nervously because it's actually pretty hilarious? Or do I like create a diversion over here, like fall out of my chair and lay on the floor like, oh, I'm hurt. Oh, I'm feeling okay. I'm good.
I hit myself in the face with a pillow over and over.
Or do I sit very quietly and maybe they're not paying full attention, which is what I ended up doing. And as that's happening, their jaws drop and they slow pan with the biggest saucer eyes to mom. And I'm like, I don't remember this part.
Wait, did you say that was your favorite part or your mom's favorite part of the movie?
The statue is in the house, and I'm not going to be descriptive because I know some of you are riding with impressionable ears in your car. Your husband's
statue of David.
Statue is in the, and then they knock the statue over, and there's a part of the statue of David that falls off, it breaks off, and they glue it back on, but they glue it on wrong because they didn't know.
They glue it on upside down. Yeah, facing the wrong direction.
And Frodo, or whatever the Hobbit's name is. What's his name? Sean Astin.
Yeah. He would have been better as Frodo at that age.
He goes, oh, no. Or he either says it or someone else says, oh, no, that's his mom's favorite part.
Oh, okay. Because I thought you said just like fleetingly, that's my mom's favorite part.
No.
And I was like, wait a minute.
It sounds like something Mouth would say.
No, but they say that. And it was like in unison, my kids just slow pan and look at me like, we thought we knew you. And I was like, I don't remember this part of the movie. But my 14-year-old's like, I'm like, sorry, now you know. You're learning things from the Goonies. I guess there's a, but anyway, this is all to say that when we were growing up, like I was like embarrassed that my kids saw that and I'd let them see it. Our parents would go to work and we would watch Jenny Jones and Jerry Springer.
Oh my gosh.
And like, everybody did that. It wasn't like we had selective.
Yeah.
That's what television was.
It was just on. You had a TV in your room a lot of times.
You'd watch soap operas because it was what was on.
I mean, I tried to avoid soap operas, but it was on TV. So I did probably watch them at some point.
Man, the 80s and the 90s were a little bit different. I do say, though, that the way that hit in the 80s or the 90s is incredibly different because we were not all day saturated in sex the way kids are today. The exposure to that type of stuff today is way more. I mean, even in commercials on the television while you're like watching a baseball game or something like that, there are things where it's like, especially going into the Halloween season where like you're going to be watching and all of a sudden you've got like a possessed woman eating somebody's face off or something like that. It's like, whoa, my 3-year-old didn't need to see that, but here we are. It's been seen.
And it's not just that it's oversaturated. It's that we knew back then, this is not really, we're peeking behind the curtain.
Yeah.
This isn't normal.
Yeah.
And that's
now it's
important.
Everywhere.
Yeah,
and
it's important.
Much more realistic than it ever was when we were growing up.
So what I brought for you for Wiggins America today is a series of stories about California. I've done this before, of course, but there's a thesis here that I want you to think about when I'm giving you these stories. You've heard the phrase before, what happens in America first happens in California, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody's heard that. So when I read these stories, I want to know whether you think that this really is a harbinger of things to come for the country. Of course, it's probably no surprise that these are not positive things. The first one is that California will be the first U.S. state to direct, this is breaking news in the last day or so, first U.S. state to direct millions of dollars from taxpayer money and tech companies to help pay for journalism and AI research under a new deal announced on Wednesday. Governor Gavin Newsom said, quote, this agreement represents a major breakthrough in ensuring the survival of newsrooms and bolstering local journalism across California. Leveraging substantial tech industry resources without imposing new taxes on Californians, the deal not only provides funding to support hundreds of new journalists, but helps rebuild a robust and dynamic California press corps for years to come, reinforcing the vital role of journalism in our democracy.
What are the requirements to receive the funding?
There's a lot of detail to this. All it says in real detail is that they modeled it after Canadian support of their journalists in Canada. So we're talking about some of their news networks. This is mostly local to California, like local news,
mm-hmm.
now going to be government funded in California. That is frightening, first of all. But second, my question for you is, is this a harbinger of things to come? We're very close to being state-run media as it is. Could this ever be federalized?
I mean, I don't know. How could it be?
I'm looking at
a free press. The First Amendment. A free press is not can't be federalized.
Well, it's not going to be a free press in California anymore. It's going to be subsidized by the government. I mean, this is the first time we've ever seen this.
Well, but that's kind of the thing. That's the rub. If there's requirements that to receive this funding, you have to make sure that you do A, B, and C, then yes, there's undue influence there. If this is just, hey, here's the government funding to ensure that everything works and keeps going, that's not necessarily the government's heavy hand, but it is a doorway to open that up, to let people in.
And can't you still report? I mean, everybody can still report. You just don't get the funding.
Well, I'm just saying this is the first time we've ever seen taxpayer money allocated to support journalism.
No, wait, that's NPR. NPR
does it a little bit. There's like 9%.
All that they do.
No, it's like 8 or 9% of their funding comes from the government. So that is there.
But it's the same thing.
But yeah, I mean, this is the first time that we've seen, and that the intent of that is so old that it was like, well, we need something for basically kids programming and stuff that's not partisan, and then it became partisan. I think that's almost like. That's almost showing exactly what's going to happen here, that it's going to start by saying, no, we're not going to dictate what they can say. But that's got to be where this goes, right? They will eventually want to say in what's reported.
Want to say and be able to say are two different things. And I think that if you have a constitutional case, and I think you have a very strong constitutional argument where they can offer you this money, you can take the money and you are under no like requirements to do what they tell you to do. I think if you took that up to the Supreme Court, I think you're going to win that every day of the week.
Mm. I don't know if my sweeper is up, but I'm going to play it anyway. There we go. Hey. Nice, Brad. Next one is California is opening quote unquote free food markets that are costing, of course, taxpayer money. San Francisco has opened a city market on Sunday where qualifying residents can receive their groceries for, quote-unquote, free. This is a supplemental source for food on top of food stamps, and they show pictures of this. It's basically homeless encampments that are being subsidized because, like we've said before, they're not signing up for the programs. They're creating literal bread lines in the United States. Again, I ask, I hope, do you think this is something we could ever see in the United States, that we go back to seeing bread lines across the country?
I mean, you just said what we are.
I'm just saying it's in California right now. I'm not seeing it here
yet.
They
are in the United States.
They are in the United States.
I know it's shocking.
Barely.
Yeah,
I mean, we're seeing it. Last one, real quick, is California's has banned single-use plastic grocery bags a long time ago, but they're seeing that it doesn't work and that there's a lot more plastic usage because people are not reusing their bags as they were supposed to.
Well, when we come back, we're going to speak with DeRoy Murdoch. We're going to talk about that RFK Jr. endorsement and how his family reacted to all of that. Don't go away.